That's our top stories in a message to the UN. Iran's president warns about the consequences of Israel's settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yemeni officials warn of a worsening humanitarian crisis in the war-torn country, saying a child dies every 10 minutes in Yemen. Also in the headlines, the U.S. president's personal lawyer attacks Attorney General Barr after he dismissed major fraud in the presidential vote. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour, Iran's president has reiterated his country's full support for the Palestinian people and called for a united global front to counter Israel's violation of international law. Hassan Rouhani made the call in an address to the UN General Assembly on the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Rouhani accused Israel of racism and organized crime against Palestinians and condemn its blockade of the Gaza Strip, especially at the time of the coronavirus pandemic. The Iranian president warned about the dangerous regional and global security consequences of Israel's settlement construction in the occupied West Bank and Judaization of Jerusalem al-Quds. He denounced the recent normalization deals between some Arab states and Tel Aviv as betrayal of the Palestinian cause, as well as Israel's repeated violations of the Syrian and Lebanese sovereignty. Coronavirus infections are rapidly rising in the Gaza Strip, with hundreds of cases being discovered on a daily basis. Palestinian health officials struggle to cope with the rising cases amid suffocating Israeli siege on the impoverished enclave. Ashraf Shannon is in Gaza.
The number of coronavirus infections is on the rise in Gaza. Infections have spiked to nearly 22,000 cases since March. Daily hospitalizations due to COVID-19 also continue to rise, bringing the average of serious and critical cases to more than 20% of confirmed cases. Some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are at the increasing risk of contracting the virus amid a severely depleted healthcare system, which is largely attributable to the Israeli regime's ongoing blockade.
The growing number of infections is exerting a lot of pressure on our health system, which is already in a bad shape because of Israel's blockade. The health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and equipment to combat the deadly pandemic.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19 since March. People in Gaza who recovered from the deadly virus are still traumatized and say they are lucky to be alive.
The coronavirus infection was a horrifying experience. As a photojournalist, I have covered Israeli wars and military bombardments, and honestly, I was much more scared when I contracted the COVID-19 virus. When facing coronavirus, you are facing an unseen enemy. Anyone can get infected, and I have seen young people fighting for their lives in intensive care units.
The pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip and left a huge negative impact on the economy.
The pandemic started to spread locally in late August, and every day we hear of hundreds of new infections. The pandemic has hurt all businesses, especially small businesses like mine. I have to work every day. And if I don't work, I will not be able to provide food for my family.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices.
Experts warn that the unprecedented surge in COVID-19 cases in the Gaza Strip will soon overwhelm the under-equipped health sector. The tiny enclave has been under a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Yemeni health ministry says a child dies every 10 minutes there as shortfalls in aid funding are worsening a humanitarian crisis.
More than 45% of children under 5 years old are malnourished. More than 2.5 million children are malnourished, including 500,000 suffering from acute malnutrition, which means if they don't get urgent care, they will die. A child like these dies every 10 minutes.
According to the UN, acute malnutrition rates among Yemeni children under the age of 5 are the highest ever recorded. Last month, the world body warned that Yemen is in an imminent danger of the worst famine the world has witnessed in decades. The Arab country has seen much of its infrastructure devastated in a Saudi-led war that started in early 2015. The aggression in tandem with a crippling blockade has pushed Yemen on the brink of what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, have been killed in the Saudi-led war. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the international community is neglecting the plight of the Yemeni people.
Saudi Arabia doesn't want to lose face. It doesn't want to be defeated by a poor country. It also has the backing of the United States. The United States provides it with weaponry. It likes to use what it has and test these weapons, and it's testing them on human victims in Yemen. What it will take for the world community to finally say no is difficult to understand, because what more needs to be seen? The constant death, suffering of children, dying by bombs, by starvation. Even if some of these children who are starving now are able to get assistance, are able to get food, the developmental challenges that they will have will remain with them throughout their lives. This is an extremely serious and extremely sad situation, and the the world community, the United Nations, are neglecting their responsibilities. The United States, of course, is complicit in all these crimes.
Bahrain's top cleric has denounced the Al Khalifa regime's decision to normalize ties with Israel. In a statement, Sheikh Isa Qasem said the Manama regime has broken with the people of Bahrain to win the United States' favor. His statement came as a Bahraini government delegation arrived in Israel to hold talks on boosting economic and tourism cooperation with the regime. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates signed U.S. brokered deals aimed at normalizing ties with Israel in mid-September. The moves have drawn widespread condemnations from the Muslim world, especially from the Palestinians. People of Palestine called the agreements a betrayal of their cause and a stab in their back. The Iranian parliament has overwhelmingly passed a bill which is aimed at putting an end to the sanctions against the country. The approval is also seen as a response to the assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist. Here's more.
Iran's parliament or majlis has endorsed a bill titled Strategic Action to Remove Sanctions and Protect the Rights of the Iranian Nation. The legislation, which still requires the endorsement of Iran's Guardian Council, is aimed at tackling U.S.-imposed sanctions against the country. The bill obliges the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to produce uranium enriched at 20% purity for peaceful purposes and store inside the country at least 120 kilograms of the product annually. The bill also mandates the installation and operation of advanced IR-2M and IR-6 centrifuges. Furthermore, it calls for a metallic uranium production plant to be put into operation in the central city of Isfahan. The Iranian lawmakers have also demanded the optimization and relaunching of Iraq's heavy water reactor and the designing of another such facility. The bill also stipulates that Iran will withdraw from the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty if the remaining parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal do not fully comply with their obligations and restrictions against Iran's trade continue to remain in place. The bill comes after repeated complaints by Iran that is not reaping the fruits of the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, while it's remained committed to the agreement.
Truth of the matter again is that the gap and the key gap and the key point of concern was a serious lack of commitment by the West, either in the United States or the European Union, that resulted in new courses of action taken by Iran.
Under the deal, Iran imposed restrictions on its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. However, U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Despite the U.S. move, Tehran remained fully compliant with the JCPOA for an entire year. But amid the failure of the remaining signatories to deliver the benefits of the deal to Iran, the country began a gradual suspension of its commitments. The timing of the approval of the bill is also noteworthy, as it comes just days after the assassination of prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh near Tehran. In fact, the bill is indeed Iran's first practical response to the assassination. Fakhrizadeh's killing is the latest in a long line of assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists blamed on Israel. Iran has vowed revenge, and judging by the swiftness and decisiveness of the parliament bill, the culprits and masterminds of the killing should be on tenterhooks.
Now, as the UK prepares to exit its second COVID-19 lockdown, all hopes seem to be pinned on a vaccine to ward off another lockdown and make life go back to normal. However, one of the challenges of mass immunization is convincing people that vaccine is safe, and the speed with which it is hitting the shelves is a source of concern. Bianca Rahimi explains.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The U.S. Justice Department says there is no proof of widespread fraud in the November 3rd presidential vote, further dimming Donald Trump's hopes of re-election. Attorney General William Barr said the department has not found fraud on a scale substantial enough to revoke Joe Biden's projected victory in the race. This is while Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, slammed Barr's remarks, accusing the Justice Department of failing to conduct proper probes. Giuliani vowed that the president's team will continue its legal fight. On Monday, Arizona and Wisconsin certified Biden's win, becoming the last of the six battleground states to do so. Trump insists that he won the race for the White House but is being cheated out of victory. Colin Campbell says U.S. President Donald Trump's claims of widespread fraud in November 3rd elections are only taken seriously by his diehard supporters.
And this is something that he's asserted after weeks of pretty much reporters and other officials saying that this is the conclusion that would inevitably happen, that the president really had no justification or evidence of there being rampant voter fraud across the country, that there are dead people voting, that there were illegal registrations, that the whole system is corrupt. All of this was said by the president to really electrify his base, that there was some wrongdoing and maybe to create some unrest that could help him stay in his position as president. But as we have observed, none of these processes or operations have been working for the president. He's really every day said that he's won the election, that the election is fraudulent, but there's been no evidence that's supporting any of this, and no one seems to be taking him seriously, except for maybe his diehard supporters. Other than that, most politicians are starting to accept that there's a transition happening. There are some Republicans who have been very quiet, but it's being reported that really they know deep down that the president lost the election, and they're just keeping quiet so as not to receive any wrath from the commander-in-chief. As we know, the president can be vindictive and vengeful, and I think that there are a lot of Republicans who are not showing or not exhibiting any bravery.
The United Nations has warned Ethiopia of the possible disastrous impact of food shortages on thousands of Eritreans sheltered in refugee camps in Tigray region. UN High Commissioner for Refugees has requested urgent access to the camps to provide emergency aid for nearly 100,000 Eritreans. The UN Refugee Agency has also voiced concerns at reports of attacks, abduction, and forced recruitment of the refugees, stressing that they are in desperate need of help. Communication and humanitarian access have been severed since a conflict between Federal Army and Tigray People's Liberation Front fighters started on November the 4th. On Sunday, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced the federal forces had taken control of Tigray's capital and fighting had stopped. And finally, in India, protests continue against agricultural reforms as talks between government and farmer representatives have failed to break a deadlock. Farmers from several northern states have been camping outside the capital, New Delhi, for nearly a week. They're protesting against a new law they fear could pave the way for the government to stop buying grain and leave them at the mercy of corporate buyers. Prior to the legislation, farmers sold their produce at government-regulated wholesale markets. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has defended the law, but the farmers want it to be repealed. On Tuesday, they also rejected a government proposal to form a committee to look into their concerns. The two sides are set to hold another round of meeting on Thursday.
Diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Pennsylvania's highest court has thrown out a lower court's order that was preventing the state from certifying dozens of contests from the 3rd of November election. In the latest Republican lawsuit attempting to thwart President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the battleground state, the state Supreme Court unanimously threw out the three-day-old order, saying the underlying lawsuit was filed months after the law allowed for challenges to Pennsylvania's year-old mail-in voting law. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian, with the Associated Press contributing to the report. The piece is titled, Pennsylvania Supreme Court Throws Out Republican Bid to Reject 2.5 Million Mail-in Votes. Stay with us for more. Pennsylvania's highest court has thrown out a lower court's order that was preventing the state from certifying dozens of contests from the 3rd of November election. In the latest Republican lawsuit attempting to thwart President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the battleground state, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court unanimously threw out the three-day-old order, saying the underlying lawsuit was filed months after the law allowed for challenges to Pennsylvania's year-old mail-in voting law. Justices also remarked on the lawsuit's staggering demand that an entire election be overturned retroactively. They have failed to allege that even a single mail-in ballot was fraudulently cast or counted, Justice David Wedge wrote in a concurring opinion. The state's Attorney General, Democrat Josh Shapiro, called the court's decision another win for democracy. The week-old lawsuit led by Pennsylvania's Republican Congressman Mike Kelly had challenged the state's mail-in voting law as unconstitutional. As a remedy, Mike Kelly and other Republican plaintiffs had sought to either throw out the 2.5 million mail-in ballots submitted under the law, most of them by Democrats, or to wipe out the election results and direct the state's Republican-controlled legislature to pick Pennsylvania's presidential electors. The request for the state's lawmakers to pick Pennsylvania's presidential electors also flies in the face of a nearly century-old state law, which grants the power to pick electors to the state's popular vote, Justice Wedge wrote. Whilst the High Court's two Republicans joined the five Democrats in opposing those remedies, they split from Democrats in suggesting that the lawsuit's underlying claims that the state's mail-in voting law might violate the Constitution are worth considering. On Wednesday, Commonwealth Court Judge Patricia McCullough, elected as a Republican in 2009, had issued the order to halt certification of any remaining contests, including apparently contests for Congress. A day earlier, Democratic Governor of Pennsylvania Tom Wolf said he had certified Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election in Pennsylvania. Biden beat President Donald Trump by more than 80,000 votes in Pennsylvania, a state Donald Trump had won back in 2016. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf had appealed Justice McCulloch's decision to the state Supreme Court, saying there was no conceivable justification for it. The defeat followed Friday's decision by a federal appeals court to dismiss a separate challenge to the Pennsylvania result and back a district judge who likened the president's evidence-free and error-strewn lawsuit to Frankenstein's monster. The three-member federal panel confirmed unanimously a lower court's decision last week to rebuff the argument made by Donald Trump's legal team, led by former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, that voting in Pennsylvania was marred by widespread fraud. Free, fair elections are the lifeblood of our democracy. Charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then they require proof. We have neither here, Judge Stefanos Bibas wrote for the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The judge denounced as breathtaking a Republican request to reverse certification of the vote, adding, "Voters, not lawyers, choose the president. Ballots, not briefs, decide elections. The campaign's claims have no merit whatsoever." The ruling, which was the Trump team's 38th court defeat in election lawsuits nationwide, reaffirmed U.S. District Judge Matthew Brand's earlier view of Giuliani's complaint, delivered after he listened to 5 hours of oral arguments last week. The lawsuit, Judge Matthew Brand said, was like Frankenstein's monster, haphazardly stitched together. Meanwhile, a Donald Trump supporter who donated $2.5 million to help expose and prosecute claims of fraud in the presidential election wants his money back after what he says are disappointing results. Frederick Eshelman, a businessman from North Carolina and a Trump supporter, said he gave the money to True the Vote, a pro-Trump election ethics group in Texas that promised to file lawsuits in 7 swing states, as part of its push to investigate, litigate, and expose suspected illegal balloting and fraud in the 2020 general election. But according to a lawsuit businessman Eshelman filed this week in Houston, Texas, True the Vote dropped its legal actions and discontinued its Validate the Vote 2020 campaign, then refused to return his calls when he demanded an explanation. The founder of Eshelman Ventures, a venture capital company, said he asked regularly and repeatedly for updates, the lawsuit asserts, but that his requests were consistently met with vague responses, platitudes, and empty promises. The lack of success of True the Vote's efforts to challenge the outcome appears to mirror that of President Donald Trump himself, whose team has lost 38 court actions since the 3rd of November presidential election, most recently in Pennsylvania, where the Federal Appeals Court panel blasted Trump's legal team for filing a case with no merit.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is a thought-stimulating saying from the Holy Prophet's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him. The heart of an ignorant is his mouth, and the mouth of a wise person is in his heart.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and this is your host Ali Maytham and you're listening to IRIB English Radio and this is For Humanity. Well, this program is all about humanity. In this program, we actually compare the human rights compared to the Islamic human rights and the Western human rights. Well, we've been discussing how, mashallah, the Westerners have been providing the human rights. How, firstly, the definition of, we talked about the definition, how they define human. We talked about how they call a human from evolution. They say he's a result of chemicals, a result of Big Bang Theory. He's a monkey. According to them, this world is a jungle and a place of survival. When we already said that, if that person has this kind of ideology, then, well, no wonder Hitler will come out and kill millions of people and you cannot even say it, because when you go to a jungle, when you go to a forest and try to, you know, take a banana from a monkey's hand, this is what obviously a monkey's going to do. He's going to end up attacking you. So with that ideology attacking, they go like, oh, no, please don't tell us, because we're the ones telling you the human rights. Don't tell us. It's not how it works. As I already even mentioned in the episodes, that these are the people who attack your brothers in Yemen, in Bahrain. I'm not even saying they're Muslims. Let's just not discriminate here. Let's just say they're humans. Habibi, you kill my brothers in Bahrain. You kill my brothers in Syria. You kill my brothers everywhere. And then you come and talk about the human rights. Well, we always in comparing how the human rights are not compatible with the divine law of Islam. Well, Islam gives you a solution to everything. Here is what the rights of protection. Now, in this episode, we're specifically going to look at the rights of protection against tyranny. Well, among the rights that Islam has conferred on human rights is the first, protection against government's tyranny. Referring to Holy Quran, says God does not love evil talk in public unless it is by someone who has been injured thereby. Chapter number 4, verse number 148. This means that God has strongly disapproved of abusive language or strong words of condemnation, but the person has been victim of injustice of tyranny, God gives them the right to openly protest against the injury that has been done to him. The right is not limited only to individuals. The words of the worst are general. Therefore, it is an individual or a person or a group or a party assert power, and after assuming the reign of authority, begins to tyrannize individuals and groups of men and the entire population of the country, then to raise the voice against and openly is a God-given right to a man, and no one has the authority to usurp or deny this right. You see that Imam al-Hussein, when he went to Karbala, he was actually against the tyranny. He was against the tyranny of Yazid. He came out and he spoke against it. But guess what? This is something I always, you know, in general tell the people. When you talk about the human rights, this is very unfortunate. When you think about, as I mentioned, Ali ibn Abi Talib was a man of justice. If you want to see justice, you can see from Ahl al-Bayt. No wonder you cannot see from any other household but the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. You see that they were the ones who told the people the human rights. But unfortunately, this is very ironic that the ones who told us about the human rights, their human rights were taken, their human rights were seized. A very simple example that you see in the history is Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Yazid ibn Muawiyah, When Imam al-Hussein went to Medina, he said, if he speaks the truth, if he speaks against it, behead him. Imam al-Hussein went to Medina. He went there as he said, you know, if Hussein speaks the truth or he speaks against us, behead him. No freedom of speech. No freedom of speech from Imam al-Hussein. And then he had to go to Kufa. And then he had to go to Karbala. So this is very unfortunate. Just wanted to put it at the end that the ones who've told us the human rights, unfortunately, their human rights were seized and they were treated unfairly. We'll be right back after a break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Before the break, we actually mentioned how there was no freedom of speech or no freedom of expression for the A'imma alayhi salam. Whether you talk about Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, when you even talk about Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, there was no freedom of speech because Mutawakkil Abbasi gave no freedom of speech to Imam Hassan al-Askari. It is very unfortunate that the ones who told us the rights of humans, their rights were seized. Whether you look at the first Imam, whether you look at the third Imam, whether you look at the 10th Imam, or you look at the 11th Imam. You see, Islam has given the freedom of expression. Islam gives the rights of freedom of thought and expression to all the citizens of Islamic State on the condition that it should be used for propagation or virtue, the truth, and not spreading evil and wickedness. The Islam concept of freedom of expression is much superior to the concept prevalent in the West. Under no circumstances would Islam not evil and wicked to the propagated. It also does not give anybody the right to use abusive or offensive language in the name of circumstances. It also does not give anybody the right to use abusive language in the name of criticism. The rights of freedom of expression for the sake of propagating virtues and righteous is not only the right in Islam, but an obligatory one who tries to deny this right to his people and openly at a war with Allah, all the powerful. And the same thing applies to attempt and stop people from evil, whether the evil is preparation or individual or by a group or a person or the government of one's own country or the government of some other country. It is a right of a Muslim. It is also his obligation that he should warn and repent the evil doers and try to stop them from doing it. Over and above, he should openly, publicly condemn and show the course of righteousness which the individual's nation and government should adopt. Though the Quran has described the quality of the faithful in the following words: they enjoin what is proper and forbid what is improper. Verse number 71, chapter number 9. In contrast, describing the qualities of a hypocrite, the Quran mentioned, they bid what is improper and forbid what is proper. Chapter number 9, verse number 67. The main purpose in Islamic government has been defined by God in the Holy Quran as, if you give authority to these men on earth, they will keep us prayers and offer poor due, bide what is proper and forbid what is improper. Chapter number 22, verse number 41. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, if any of you come across an evil, he should try to stop it with his hand using force. And if he's not in a position to stop him with his hands, he should try to stop him by using his tongue. Means should he should speak against it. If he's not able to use his tongue, he should at least condemn it in his heart. That is the weakest degree of faith of a Muslim. So that is it for today. Don't forget to visit our website, which is www.parstoday.com, and click on the tab Call of Islam, where you can find our programs as well as this one. And you can email us and contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. With that being said, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa alin nabiyyil azim. اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم
Saudi Royal Family
Part 1
The sword has always been a beloved and vital object in the House of Saud. In the early 20th century, they expanded their kingdom in Saudi Arabia, relying on Wahhabi and Bedouin people called the Muslim Brotherhood. Even hundreds of years later, the sword is still prominent in Saudi royal family's glorious festivals with leaders of great nations of the world. But now, the Saudi royal family is spending petrodollars to buy modern arms, and the sword, that is a relic of the past, is the only ornament of the events. But all these arms purchases have not been able to help maintain the glory of this family in critical moments, as it did 100 years ago. Today, the Saudi royal family needs the sword even more than when they took power in the Arabian Peninsula with the Muslim Brotherhood swords.
Look at the whole country, where it was, where it is now. Now, if you tell me that building this whole country and spending 350 billion out of 400 billion, that we had a misused or get corrupted with 50 billion, I'll tell you yes, but I'll take that any time.
We did not invent corruption. This happened since Adam and Eve. I mean, Adam and Eve were in heaven, and they had hanky-panky, and they had to go down to earth. So, I mean, this is human nature.
But we are not as bad as you think.
Bandar bin Sultan received an Airbus A340 just as one of his birthday gifts, one that was worth $75 million. This gift is decorated with the color of his favorite football team, Dallas Cowboys. Bandar bin Sultan is the son of one of the 14 wives of Sultan bin Abdulaziz. He received pilot training in Cranwell, England, and then joined Royal Saudi Air Forces in 1969 as a second lieutenant. He was knowledgeable in this field.
His Royal Highness Prince Bandar has been at the heart of many of the great world events of the past 30 years. I was always pleased to see him when I was Prime Minister, because he brought me extraordinary insights and bold proposals. I know how much he has contributed to Saudi Arabia's friendship with the United States. We in Britain also have a special affection for him because of his early training at Royal Air Force Cranwell and his generous support for good causes here. It's wonderful to see his contribution to world affairs properly recognized in this excellent book by William Simpson. I salute a prince, a statesman, and a friend.
In 2006, Margaret Thatcher talked about the biography of Bandar bin Sultan that was written by his close friend, William Simpson. She did it because of Bandar bin Sultan's high-level position. This message indicates complex and yet deep Saudi-UK relations.
I'm delighted to send you this message to mark the publication of The Prince. The book tells the story of a truly remarkable man, fighter pilot, ambassador, indefatigable traveler, a man of action.
The story of Bandar bin Sultan's political life is a special example of the power structure in the House of Saud and what goes on between Saudi Arabia and other countries. Bandar started his journey flying his birthday gift, a story that is always linked to oil and arms in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia began arms purchase in the 1960s, a time when Saudi oil revenues were rising and growing every day. Jeffrey Edwards, a businessman from Yorkshire, traveled to Saudi Arabia to sign civil contracts in 1962. Later, he realized that there was a profitable market for arms sales. He went to Jeddah and began to establish close ties with one of the key members of the royal family, Sultan bin Abdulaziz, Minister of Defense and Aviation. Of course, at this time, the United States was one of Britain's serious rivals in this trade, which was trying to sign contracts to deliver arms to Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. refused to provide advanced fighters such as Starfighter, made by Lockheed Martin, due to concerns about the Saudi military's superiority in the region and destabilization of the security, especially in relation to Israel. The King of Saudi Arabia was disappointed with the U.S. arms deal, and this disappointment created a golden opportunity for Britain.
Foreign buyers representing airlines, air forces, and industry came, saw, and were conquered. Within hours of the show opening, salesmen had taken orders worth millions and had the promise of more contracts to follow.
After several years of Jeffrey Edwards' efforts, Britain became able to sell a significant amount of modern military weapons to Saudi Arabia. It was coincided with the formation of governments by the British Labour Party in 1964, a time when the country was facing a severe financial crisis. It was the greatest contract up to that date.
His Majesty King Faisal had flown to London Airport. He now arrived by car at the Tate Gallery, where he was welcomed by the Queen and Duke.
When Faisal bin Abdulaziz Al Saud came to power in Saudi Arabia, West Asia was at the height of the Arab Cold War. Saudi royal family sought to protect Saudi Arabia from the region's growing dangers by purchasing modern Western arms. This contract was signed officially in December 1965. It included 42 BAC Lightning aircraft and a number of aerial surveillance systems. Faisal was assassinated in a terrorist act by a member of the royal family in 1975, but the arms deals remained intact. The next arms deal was reached in 1976, a year after King Faisal's death, as Sultan bin Abdul Aziz was still Saudi defense minister. Britain was trying to make the Royal Saudi Air Force completely dependent on itself by selling such amounts of weapons. During these years, numerous contracts were signed for the supply of Saudi weapons. British companies paid a large sum of money as bribes to princes, especially the Saudi Minister of Defense. For instance, in the 1977 contract, which was worth £500 million, they paid £60 million to princes who played key roles, and the UK government was aware of it. In fact, the money was paid to the princes out of Saudi citizens' pocket. William Morris wrote in a note that the Saudi royal family had turned Saudi Arabia into a private, exclusive, and family-owned company. But Al Yamamah was an unbelievable deal which came up later. In the early 80s, Britain was trying to sign new foreign contracts as the country was facing a severe financial crisis.
We're in the Ministry of Defense in Whitehall. Behind these doors, there's a room which few people, apart from Arab sheikhs and other potential foreign customers, have ever set eyes on before. This is it, the Permanent Defense Equipment Exhibition, the supermarket of the sales organization which this year will sell nearly £600 million worth of British military hardware to foreign governments. Week in, week out, overseas service chiefs come here discreetly to shop for anything from guided missile destroyers and aircraft to a pair of army boots.
Saudi Arabia and Britain entered into tough and breathtaking negotiations to sign a historic arms deal called Al Yamamah. The deal could save Britain's bankrupt economy led by Margaret Thatcher. The key figure in this lucrative trade was none other than the son of the then Minister of Defense, Bandar bin Sultan. He was the grandson of Abdul Aziz, the founder of Saudi Arabia, who was the country's powerful ambassador to Washington since 1985. The deal was concluded on September the 26th, 1985, and was worth £43 billion. It was the largest trade deal in British exports history to date and seriously affected the political ties between Britain and Saudi Arabia for the next 30 years.
The extraordinary arms deal, which has impressed military experts throughout the world, it emerged today that Britain and Saudi Arabia have signed what's thought to be one of the world's biggest arms agreements. The deal will mean Saudi Arabia will get many more combat planes, training aircraft, new mine hunters, two new air bases, and much training and support. It means Britain is pulling level with, if not overtaking, the United States as the biggest military supplier to the Saudis.
BAE was the most important company in this deal because the largest volumes of these orders were Tornadoes, Hawk jets training aircraft, and missiles for these fighters. In return, Saudi Arabia paid 600,000 barrels of oil a day to Britain for this military equipment. The deal created thousands of direct jobs in Britain as well as in Saudi Arabia. Margaret Thatcher's son in Britain and Bandar bin Sultan in Saudi Arabia, who signed these deals at the highest levels, benefited the most. Newly and erroneously released British government secret documents state that each Tornado was worth £16 million. Bandar bin Sultan's father paid £21 million for each, so he paid £600 million in total. BAE, the British Defense, Security and Aerospace Company, was the contracting party in Al Yamamah deal. BAE is the second largest defense industry company in the world after Lockheed Martin. Not every term of the deal was disclosed, but the ones that were revealed the purchase of more than 96 Tornado fighter jets, 24 Tornado air defense fighter jets, 50 Hawks, and 50 Pilatus PC-9 training aircraft as its main part. Many missiles and ammunition were also purchased for these aircraft. A significant amount of money was spent on training, repairing, and the maintenance of these arms. Of course, this was only the first phase of the deal, and the second phase was signed on July the 3rd, 1988. In the remote island of Bermuda, where the defense ministers of both countries were present. Now we may easily understand which deals prompted a $75 million birthday present for Bandar bin Sultan. BAE gave him this gift for his efforts to sign a Yamama deal so that he could comfortably have his business and leisure trips around the world. It took a year to make his favorite interior design so he could go on his long journeys seeking his strange plans. He celebrated his meetings and birthday parties with his friends on this plane. He made a great profit in this historic deal, and it made him one of the key players in Saudi royal family. In the following years, he reached an important position in the country's foreign relations, which was specially related to Washington and London. His role was changing at the time. He was changing from a pacifist diplomat to a sponsor of the CIA's secret operations around the world in the 1980s, and most importantly, an arms dealer.
You have no problems working with the CIA.
We have no problem working with the United States government. And unless the CIA does not work for the United States government, then I think we have a bigger problem.
There have been occasions when some Americans have questioned that, as you know.
Well, thank heavens those occasions was not in connection with Saudi Arabia.
He was in charge of one of the most important UK-Saudi activities, and that was funding secret CIA's projects around the world. One of the most important cases was funding the Contras to fight against the revolutionary government in Nicaragua. The Reagan administration, with the guidance of national security advisors, gave the Contras large sums of money to continue their activities, and Saudi Arabia was one of the main sources.
The joint hearings of the House Select Committee to Investigate Covert Arms Transaction will come to order.
Assistance we could provide, some cases arms sales, and he intended to provide a contribution of $1 million per month to the Contras through the end of the year.
Since the middle of 1984, the United States provided $1 million a month for the Contras, and that amount was doubled since early 1985. The Contras received a total of $32 million. The Contra rebels, whom Reagan called freedom fighters, did not refrain from committing any crime against Nicaraguan people in the 1980s. Another generous Saudi contribution to CIA projects was the $50 million donation to UNITA rebel group in Angola to overthrow the MPLA communist government through Morocco.